Today is Thursday, September 9th, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinua Adofo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, U.S. ramps up diplomatic efforts on Afghanistan.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken is stepping up efforts to get a grip on the situation in Afghanistan.
Plus, UN seeks humanitarian assistance to millions of Afghans.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warns Afghanistan is facing a looming humanitarian catastrophe.
Also, New Zealand to enact new terrorism laws. Our top story today is in Afghanistan. Several news outlets report that Afghanistan's Taliban authorities will allow about 200 foreigners, including Americans, to fly out from Kabul. This will mark the airport's first such flight since the U.S. forces withdrew from the country. The group are to depart Thursday on a Qatar Airlines flight that had earlier ferried humanitarian aid to the country, said Mokhlad bin Majid al-Qahtani, a Qatari special envoy. Al-Qahtani said it was the first international commercial flight from Kabul airport since American forces left at the end of August, their departure accompanied by a frantic airlift of tens of thousands of foreign citizens and Afghans fleeing the Taliban. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is seeking to boost international diplomatic efforts regarding Afghanistan by co-hosting a ministerial meeting in Germany following the chaotic end of America's 20-year presence in the country. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken is stepping up efforts to get a grip on the situation in Afghanistan, meeting with German Foreign Minister Heiko Maas at Ramstein Air Base in Germany. Blinken acknowledged that planes chartered to bring Americans, their families, and at-risk Afghans out of the country have been stuck at Mazar-e-Sharif International Airport in Afghanistan.
As of now, the Taliban are not permitting the charter flights to depart. They claim that some of the passengers do not have the required documentation. While there are limits to what we can do without personnel on the ground, without an airport, with normal security and procedures in place, we are working to do everything in our power to support those flights and to get them off the ground.
Germany has been a major transit point for Americans and Afghans evacuated since the Taliban took power in Kabul in mid-August. Asked how the U.S. and Germany will deal with Afghanistan's new interim government, whose interior minister is wanted by the Federal Bureau of Investigation, German Foreign Minister Heiko Maas said he was not optimistic about the caretaker Taliban government, but added he has to talk with them.
We have had direct talks with the Taliban. Up to now, if we hadn't done that, we wouldn't have been able to evacuate vulnerable groups, Germans, Afghans, from Afghanistan. We still have German nationals in Afghanistan, but we don't have any diplomatic representation in Kabul, Afghanistan. So in order to evacuate these German nationals, we need to have people to talk to on the ground.
Earlier Wednesday, Blinken met at the base with U.S. personnel and Afghan refugees waiting to board flights to America. Blinken told them that many Americans are excited to welcome them. One Afghan refugee, who did not give his name, said much remains uncertain.
Yeah, first we're going to land in D.C. So we have some process going on, the biometric and everything else. While we are done with the documents, everything else, then they're going to take us to the camp. And we don't know where, because that's up to them.
As some Afghans prepare to start new lives abroad, a few Afghan women protested in Kabul again Wednesday at the announcement of an all-male, all-Taliban, hardline interim government. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
Turkey is voicing caution over Afghanistan's interim government as it continues talks with the Taliban on restarting regular air traffic at the Kabul airport. For VOA from Istanbul, Dorian Jones reports on the delicate diplomatic balancing act Turkey is performing with the Taliban.
Turkey was among the first countries calling for talks and engagement with the Taliban after it swept to power last month. But the Taliban's announcement of an interim government this week saw Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan calling for a cautious approach. As you know, right now it's hard to call it permanent, but an interim cabinet has been announced, Erdogan said Tuesday. He said, we don't know how long this interim cabinet will last. All we have to do is to follow this process carefully. But Erdogan said talks between the Taliban and Qatar on restarting full operations at the Kabul airport were making progress, although he warned key issues remained unresolved. On Monday, Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu said the Taliban's insistence on being the one to provide the airport security remains a key obstacle.
Birçok ülke büyükelçiliğini buradan geri çekerken,
Cavusoglu said the Taliban or Afghan forces could ensure security outside the airport, but inside, he said, there should be a security company trusted by the international community. He added that otherwise, even if airlines, including Turkish Airlines, are keen to fly there, insurance companies would not allow it. Despite Turkey's participation in NATO's 20-year-long military presence in Afghanistan, the Taliban reached out to Ankara with calls to put the airport back into operation. Turkey is NATO's only Muslim member and it shares historical ties with Afghanistan. Asla Aydintashbash, a senior fellow at the European Council, says Ankara believes these factors could help Turkey play a key role in Afghanistan.
They'll want to see if they can position Turkey as a diplomatic conduit, as a diplomatic sort of a go-between between Western countries and the Taliban.
The reopening of the Kabul airport is key for European countries and the United States in efforts to evacuate their citizens who are still in Afghanistan, as well as Afghan nationals who once worked for NATO and Western embassies. After meeting his Turkish counterpart, German Foreign Minister Heiko Maas underlined Turkey's importance in efforts to reopen the airport, offering to help finance the operation. But retired Turkish ambassador Selim Kunaalp says Ankara must deal delicately with the Taliban.
It seems to me that there would be a risk in appearing to be too close to the Taliban, to appear as their protectors, so to speak, in the eyes of the West, not just the United States, but the European Union too, because if you appear to be very close to them, then you're painted with the same brush.
Ankara's cautious approach to the new Afghan government and Turkish calls for scrutiny of the Taliban's treatment of women and ethnic minorities could be signs of a growing awareness of Turkey's need to remain aligned with its Western allies over Afghanistan. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
A UN-sponsored high-level ministerial meeting on Afghanistan next week will seek to raise $606 million to provide life-saving humanitarian assistance for nearly 11 million people until the end of the year. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warns Afghanistan is facing a looming humanitarian catastrophe. The UN chief will travel to Geneva to convene next Monday's meeting to gain the support of the international community to address the growing needs in the country. The United Nations reports nearly half of Afghanistan's population of 38 million needs humanitarian aid. Among them are 3.5 million people internally displaced by conflict. The UN Children's Fund reports 600,000 children under age 5 are suffering from severe acute malnutrition, a dangerous condition that could kill them if they do not receive emergency aid. Spokesman for the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, Jens Lajerke, says the appeal will provide treatment for more than 1 million children and women suffering from acute malnutrition. He says the appeal also aims to deliver critical food, essential health services, water and sanitation, emergency education, shelter, and other relief.
Humanitarian organizations have decades of experience in delivering relief in Afghanistan. This year alone, 8 million people have received assistance. But basic services in Afghanistan are collapsing, and food and other life-saving aid is about to run out.
The World Food Program reports 1 in 3 people in Afghanistan is going hungry. WFP spokesman Thompson Theory says the humanitarian crisis unfolding in the country will worsen during the fast approaching winter season. He says WFP is racing to pre-position food before the snow cuts off access to large areas of the country.
In just a few weeks, sadly, our food will run out. We have called for resources and we are urgently requiring $200 million to assist 14 million people between now and the end of 2021. The need to get timely contributions whilst we still have a window of opportunity to bring in food.
UN agencies vow to remain in Afghanistan and provide humanitarian aid despite increasing insecurity under Taliban rule. UN officials say they have been present in the country for nearly four decades and have experience in working with different authorities, even the Taliban, when the militant group last held power between 1996 and 2001. The UN assures international donors none of their money will end up in government hands. UN officials say all money is channeled to implementing agencies on the ground who will put it to good use. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Former Afghan President Ashraf Ghani, who fled Kabul as Taliban forces reached the outskirts of the city last month, apologized on Wednesday for the abrupt fall of his government, but denied that he had taken millions of dollars with him. Brian Wood of Reuters reports.
Former Afghan President Ashraf Ghani apologized on Wednesday for the fall of his government. He fled the capital city, Kabul, last month as Taliban forces approached the outskirts of the city. In a statement posted on Twitter, Ghani said he'd left under the direction of his security team, adding, quote, "Leaving Kabul was the most difficult decision of my life, but I believed it was the only way to keep the guns silent and save Kabul and her 6 million citizens." He had been accused by former allies of betrayal immediately after he fled to the United Arab Emirates. There were reports that he had left with millions of dollars in cash, but the former World Bank official denied those allegations, calling them, quote, completely and categorically false. Ghani expressed gratitude to Afghans for their sacrifices over the last 40 years of war and said he deeply regretted that his leadership ended without stability and prosperity. He was first elected president in 2014 after a heavily disputed election over claims of voter fraud.
That's Brian Wood of Reuters. Australia's biggest news publishers are responsible for comments that readers post on their corporate Facebook pages, the High Court ruled on Wednesday. The court dismissed an appeal against a previous ruling that found in favor of a defamation suit by Dylan Voller, who said that after stories referring to him were posted on Facebook pages run by various news companies, a number of third-party users had made defamatory comments. He alleged that the media outlets were liable as the publishers. After a court found in favor of Voller, the news companies appealed based on the argument that they administered a Facebook page which third parties publish their own material. However, the High Court dismissed the appeal and ordered the organizations to pay costs. A spokesperson for the Nine Network, which is involved in the suit, said they were disappointed by the outcome and that it would have ramifications on what they could post on social media in future. Peter O'Brien is Voller's attorney.
Well, essentially, this decision means that media companies are going to be responsible for their traffic and their pages and social media platforms. And if there is something that's written about their articles or their posts by a third party, they're responsible for it. And that what that means for people who might be vulnerable to social media mob attacks, they're protected essentially by this decision because it means that the media companies bear responsibility for those posts. We were heartened by the decision. We always thought that media companies who obviously benefit commercially from having Facebook pages and having posts attached to that raise their revenues by way of advertising revenue, and obviously there's a commercial incentive for that sort of social media platform, then they have to be responsible for what goes on it and what is posted towards it. And that's what the High Court has said today. And what this really does is protect people against social media mob attacks, and that's a very key and significant part of this decision.
That's Peter O'Brien, attorney for Voller. This is the Voice of America. Civil defense forces carrying rifles and health workers wearing gas masks and red Hamza suits have paraded in North Korea's capital in a celebration of the nation's 73rd anniversary that was a marked departure from the past militaristic displays. The parade, overseen by leader Kim Jong-un, centered around public security forces instead of the major military units that handle Kim's nuclear and missile arsenal. The government of North Macedonia has held an emergency meeting over a fire overnight that ripped through a field hospital set up to treat COVID-19 patients, leaving 14 people dead. The blaze broke out late Wednesday in the western city of Tetovo, where the hospital has been set up following a recent spike in infections in the region that left local hospitals full. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. New Zealand is reviewing its terror laws after a knife-wielding Sri Lankan man attacked shoppers at an Auckland supermarket before police shot him dead. Authorities said he was inspired by the Islamic State group. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The proposed New Zealand's counter-terror legislation bill would criminalise the planning of a terror attack. It would close what critics have said was a loophole that's allowed suspected extremists to continue posing a threat. The attacker was under police surveillance but was recently released with a year-long probation. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern said Saturday that there is a plan to pass the new law by the end of this month. Andrew Little, the minister responsible for the intelligence agencies, said in a statement to Parliament Tuesday that New Zealand must learn from the September 3rd Auckland supermarket attack and remain vigilant to keep the community safe. He said New Zealand wasn't immune to the threat of terrorist violence in March 2019, and we're not immune now, and we won't be in the future. Andrew Geddes, a law professor at Otago University, says defining what constitutes the planning of a terrorist attack could be problematic.
There may be other individuals out there like this guy that the legislation, this new provision, can be used to try to stop. The problem, of course, is that planning or preparing to do something can be quite a slippery concept. And so the worry is, how far will this new offence stretch into people thinking about, talking about, writing about things that they may never actually do in practice?
The Auckland supermarket attacker was identified as 32-year-old Ahmed Atul Mohammed Samsudeen, according to court documents. For more than 4 years, New Zealand had tried to deport him and strip him of his refugee status, granted in 2013, following his arrival to the country 10 years ago. Prime Minister Ardern said the process had been frustrating. The attacker was a Tamil Muslim from Sri Lanka who arrived in New Zealand on a student visa and sought asylum. In 2016, he was warned about posting violent pro-Islamic State group content online. He was later charged with various offences and spent 3 years in prison awaiting trial and was convicted but released on a supervision order in July. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
A judge trying suspects in a major terror attack in Paris that killed 130 people briefly suspended the hearing on Thursday after the main defendant tried for a second day to make political points. The judge granted suspect Salah Abdesalam the right to speak in a discussion about which victims' representatives will be allowed to participate in the trial. Abdesalam asked whether the victims of wars in Syria and Iraq would be invited to testify and alleged that he and his fellow defendants were being treated as if they had already been found guilty. He also said that some of his co-accused were not involved in the Paris attack and had only helped him because they were his friends. Reuters reports the judge repeatedly admonished him that he was straying off the topic of the hearing and eventually cut off Abdeslam's microphone. Abdeslam is believed to be the only surviving member of the Islamist militant group that carried out the gun and bomb attacks on 6 restaurants and bars, the Bataclan Concert Hall and a sports stadium in Paris on November 13, 2015. The United States marks the 20th anniversary this week of the 9/11 attacks on the country. Longtime journalist Adam Phillip was part of the team of VOA reporters, editors, and engineers covering the attacks and their aftermath. Phillip, who recently retired after 28 years with VOA, spent time recording the work he did bringing the story to the world. He spoke with VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson recently about his work in those days.
Well, the very first day, I was just driving in my car down to VOA, which, as you know, is like at the heart of the nation's capital. And I remember hearing that there was a plane that had hit the World Trade Center on National Public Radio, and then another plane hit. And I remember going into my editor's office as that moment happened. And we all went, oh, my gosh, this is intentional. This is a terrorist attack. I was immediately sent to the White House, which was being evacuated. And then I was sent to the Pentagon, which is the seat of our military, which was also hit by a plane. And I just remember the rows and rows and rows of ambulances waiting to get in while the inferno raged on within the military building. Manhattan Island itself was closed to anybody. Nobody can get off the island or out of the or on the island. There were ferry boats going from Manhattan to people's homes in New Jersey, et cetera, but there were no trains in. There was no public transportation until the very next morning. And I made darn sure that I was that I was on that train. I just started asking questions and I tried to keep my heart open and see what was going on for people, because it's just the impact of what happened on them. That was my brief. That was what they wanted me to talk about.
Now, you are primarily a feature reporter telling stories about human life and human emotion, not necessarily the sort of breaking news reporters where you're standing up saying, oh, the president has just said this. How did you go about your work then in New York?
Yeah, you're right. For me, as a features reporter, also called a background reporter, because it's not always fluffy, the idea is that the news that happens, what the president says or the planes hit, that just gets you in the game. That's just the occasion for finding out from people what they're feeling, what they're thinking about, what's going to happen next, if that's what their concern is, and all the emotions that were going on that day, including lots of shock and grief. But I just rented a hotel room on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, and a couple blocks away, I was near Lincoln Center, and the whole plaza there had turned into a place for recruiting volunteers for the Red Cross and all kinds of other stuff. There was people, civilians, really, really self-mobilized. And also, you know, joined NGOs and other groups to see anything they could do to comfort people, to look for somebody, to type a letter for somebody, to make photocopies of missing posters. So I went there and I just asked them what they were doing and why they wanted to volunteer and how they felt about this moment. You can imagine how much material was on the ground smoldering there from those huge, huge, huge buildings. And so it fell to some people to go to what they call the pile, and to go in there with trucks and put all that smoldering stuff, that totally unbelievably toxic, horrible stuff, onto trucks and then bring it to the barges and send it down to Fresh Kills, this place in New Jersey. And so I spent a lot of time there and interviewing some of these guys. I'm sure most of them are dead now, you know, who just went back and forth and back and forth. And it was a spiritual experience for a lot of them. I mean, they were angry and they just really felt it was their job to do it. Another thing I did was I went to a town called Middletown, New Jersey, which was a beautiful little bedroom, I guess, small city in New Jersey where a lot of workers in the World Trade Center lived. And I went there to just talk to the characters who were there about what it's like for this town to go through this grief. So I spoke to somebody whose husband was still missing. I spoke to a detective whose sorry job it was to knock on doors and say, look, we found the remains to your wife. And the police chief, you know, who started crying. And it became sort of a portrait of grief writ large. Again, it's not news, but it's something that wouldn't have happened without the news. It was tied to the news. And so that's the kind of stuff I was doing.
That was former VOA journalist Adam Phillips speaking with my colleague, Kate Pound-Dawson. Chancellor Angela Merkel says her party is fighting and was always aware that it wouldn't, quote, automatically, unquote, hold on to Germany's top job after her 16 years in power. Merkel was downplaying alarming poll rating as the country's election nears. Recent polls have shown Merkel's union bloc under would-be successor Armin Laschet is in second place behind the central-left Socialist Democrats with very low support of around 20%. It is running short of time to turn things around before September 26th parliamentary elections. Merkel has largely stayed out of the campaign, but she has made a number of interventions lately. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit boanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. Thank you so much for listening and have a great evening.